If you read Richmond newspapers, Clay McLeod Chapman's name is everywhere. Carrie Neiman of Style Weekly wrote a beautiful feature on his creative genius this week. C3 hired him to speak there last week. The Firehouse Theater commissioned him to write the play that he's performing there over the next 2 weeks. All of these people, the people who love his work, are writers. Why do writers love him? In my opinion, it's because he's fearless. Imagine yourself in bed at night and lingering in the crevices of your mind, looking for that last thought, waiting to fall asleep. The thoughts that seep in are dark, humorously dark. They are also the words most of us would never dare speak aloud. Those thoughts, Republican Congress spends billions to keep silently put to bed. Clay's writing is a celebration of the dark, perverted hilarity that comes only when a mind is completely at rest. He's like finding a Toblerone or Godiva chocolate bar in an alley, dropped next to a puddle, and picking it up and eating it. Richly sweet, dark, and perverted. Writers love him because he's not afraid to explore places where we would never go. His mind hand sews cocktail dresses on cockroaches and lingers in dumpsters to see what the view becomes. His subjects include rodeo clowns, hermaphrodites, and sexually frustrated ventriloquist dummies. You, me, a lot of us don't go there. The forbidden places of oddity and exploitation. He puts his out in public, like Grimm's fairy tales for adults. The writers who love him, the Firehouse Theater, for example, are not wrong in their passion of Clay. He's won the MacArthur Genius Award for $100,000. MacArthur, as in this program brought to you by the MacArthur Foundation, heard daily on Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Car Talk. Clay's also written two books, Rest Area and Miss Corpus, and recently had one of his short stories converted into a film that was aired at the Sundance Film Festival. And his off-Broadway theater production of The Pumpkin Pie Show has played in Brooklyn for 8 years. Clay McLeod Chapman is only 27. The best way to describe Clay's work is to let Clay read it.
This is a piece called Party Favors, and it's just a short story that I wrote recently, back in January. And you know, the only thing that you have to understand to get into it is that just think of me as a woman, and the rest will be downhill from there.
Okay.
Party Favors. My husband purchased our first camcorder just a few days before Jimmy's 5th birthday, nearly 20 years ago now. His party's one of our first memories captured on video, leaving us with hours worth of grainy footage, these pixelated visions of party favors waving through the air. There's at least 3 tapes of Jimmy opening his presents, blowing out the candles on his cake. Even me cleaning up after everybody had left. Put that thing away and help me pick up. You can hear me yelling on the camera, you know, caught swearing for the rest of my life. It may have been our son's birthday, but it was my husband who was acting like he'd just gotten a new toy, refusing to put that clunky contraption down all day, recording every spare snippet that caught his eye. The moment I remember best is Jimmy playing pin the tail on the donkey, where I'm blindfolding him in the backyard, the rest of the kids forming a circle surrounding Jimmy as I spin him around 3 times, all of his friends just counting off behind him with each turn. 1, 2, 3, and finally letting him go. Watching him wobble on his own, back and forth, all dizzy, reaching his arms out in front of him, trying to get his balance back. Getting tangled up into the streamers hanging from the trees, suddenly mummifying himself in crepe paper, just searching desperately for that donkey. My husband sneaks up in front of him, trying not to make a sound, only for Jimmy to start marching straight for the video camera, aiming his pin directly at the lens. There's about 10 seconds worth of Jimmy just filling up the frame, smiling. His eyes hidden behind that blindfold, reaching out for the camera, only a few feet away from pinning his father with the donkey tail. You see, my husband hadn't mastered the autofocus yet, trying to keep up with Jimmy while tightening in on the focal point, following him through the viewfinder. So most of the footage is a bit blurred. Everybody's laughing, though. These images of children in the backyard, giggling as Jimmy stumbles around. I can't tell you when I last saw that video. It had to have been years ago. You know, it wasn't until recently that I even thought about it, having to rummage through a few boxes in the closet to find the tape in the first place, dusting it off and slipping it into our VCR. I'd completely forgotten all about it. Up until I saw Jimmy on the 6 o'clock news, blindfolded all over again. The image has the same grainy quality to it, shot on some shoddy camcorder, the autofocus fluctuating back and forth before finally settling on his face. His features clarifying themselves after a few seconds, his tousled hair, the bruises on his cheek, his unshaven chin, the whiskers just barely beginning to sprout. They have him kneeling in the foreground, while right behind him there are these three hooded men pressing their rifles against their chests. Their faces are swathed in these red checkered keffiyehs, made from the same material as the table spreads we'd use for our backyard barbecues, looking as if they'd wrap their heads in picnic blankets. There is a banner hanging from the wall, written in Arabic. It took me three blinks before I could stop myself from thinking it said happy birthday in some foreign language. This looks familiar to me, I thought. Where have I seen this before? And sure enough, it all comes flooding back to me in that moment. The blindfold, the banner, the people in the background. This was Jimmy's fifth birthday party all over again. Hearing him plead for his life, I remember feeling familiar with that tone of voice, recognizing how it sounded. This is when Jimmy gives up on the game, I said to myself. This is when he pulls off his blindfold to see how far away he is from that donkey, kicking his heels when he sees that he's only a few inches off. But the men won't let him peek, insisting that he keep playing, shoving the butts of their rifles into his back whenever he stops talking, repeating the same statement over and over again. When the anchorman began reporting about a relief worker in Iraq getting kidnapped, I panicked, grabbing the closest video cassette I could find, slipping it into our VCR and pressing record just in time to get Jimmy. He's wearing an orange jumpsuit that doesn't look familiar to me. It's not something that I've ever seen him in before. Definitely not something that I bought for him. But he is saying something to the camera, his voice sounding hollow, dissonant. The acoustics of the room are terrible. The microphone picking up the hum of the fluorescent lights over his head. You can barely even hear him. The news had edited his segment down to a few seconds, cutting out all the parts that are spoken in Arabic, leaving in Jimmy's plea to American soldiers. This is my last chance, Jimmy weeps, bowing his head. Please, help me. And I ended up accidentally taping over the last half of our vacation to the Florida Keys. There are about 3 minutes of me and my husband sunbathing on the beach, the video camera on me, holding my hand up to my forehead, shielding my eyes from the light, only to cut right to that yellow and black sunburst, that banner of the jihad hanging from the back wall. Whoever's behind the camera, you can tell he wants to frame the shot perfectly, staging everything so that he can get the best composition, getting the lights just right. Where should the hooded men stand? How close they should be to their hostage? An inch to the left, an inch to the right. Take a step forward and stop. But I can't help myself from seeing my son sitting at the picnic table in our backyard, his friends all crowding around him, all of them leaning over his shoulders just as he's about to blow out the candles on his cake. What I am watching on the national news is nothing but some party game. I have spent the entire week sitting in front of the television, watching through all of our home movies, hours and hours worth of our family's life. When I make my way through one tape, I will pop in the next, sifting through the last 20 years, watching every moment we ever recorded on camera. All of Jimmy's birthday parties, our family vacation to the Bahamas, our trip to Disneyland, trips to the beach, Thanksgiving pageants, Christmas dinners, anniversary parties, heading off to the prom, Jimmy's senior recital, Jimmy's high school graduation, Jimmy's first day of college. What I don't have is his beheading. None of the networks will send me a copy, no matter how much I beg. Even if he is my son, no one will let me see. Thank you.
Oh, my God. Now, your voice completely changed at the end, and you get wrapped up, it seems. Is this true? Do you really get wrapped up in what you're reading and what you're writing about?
Yes. I mean, the work is going to stay static. When it's written, the text stays the same. It's not something that's malleable. I mean, it's printed, so it's one of those situations where once it's in book form, all of a sudden you've got this kind of structure, this like regulation or relegation. And because of that, it's more or less the ghost in the machine, and I think that's the performative element. Like, you can extrapolate a certain emotional content. There's something to it that if you read it to yourself, you're totally going to get something from it. But you also have the opportunity, because it's in first-person form, because it's this narrative of this character, it's told from the perspective of the I, the me. If you get an actor behind it, all of a sudden, it becomes this completely other form. And it's in the reading of it that, for me at least, in my interpretation of the text, like, I have the freedom or the privilege to kind of, like, let this be the floodgate that opens up to kind of let this emotion out. And that's the amazing thing about the performative aspect to these pieces. The text is going to stay the same. It's not going to change. But as an actor, as a performer, as someone who is even remotely theatrically inclined, because it's told from the perspective of the I, of the me, all of a sudden you just have this platform, this emotional dam just breaks. And here comes, you know, this emotional sensibility. And I think it's just purely because the text is written in such a way that you have this kind of ski slalom. You know, it starts here, but, you know, the more it gains momentum, all of a sudden it just, you're free flow.
So your old work wasn't political, you know. It was subversive, and you know, people could extrapolate some kind of political feel to it, but but nothing like this. What happened?
Well, I mean, I think the country kind of happened. This last year has been a pretty poopy year, and it's those circumstances where I still, to this day, don't think that I'm writing politically. I don't think I was writing politically 5 years ago. I don't think yesterday I was writing politically. I think, if anything, it's the personal politics that interests me, whether that's someone who loses their daughter at a rest stop versus a mother who's watching her son's hostage tape on the national news. It's not so much that it gauges the political climate of America or of any, you know, country as much as it is these particular characters, these particular people dealing with this situation. And to me, I'm not a big fan of soapboxing. Like, I'm not a big fan of people kind of trumpeting their cause, because I feel as if I, as a human being, put up a natural defense mechanism. Like, a wall goes up every time someone tells me what they think in terms of me versus the masses. Like, if someone's not going to talk to me as a human being, as a person engaged in a dynamic or in, like, a personal conversation, I feel as if, you know, whoever I am could be completely supplanted with someone else. You know, it doesn't matter who I am if you're kind of spouting your cause. The trick, I think, is to get under the radar, get under the skin, and make it personal, make it something that you, as the listener to this whatever the agenda is, whatever the topic at hand of this conversation is, if you can somehow make that person who's listening to you, whether it's one person, whether it's 50 people, whether it's a whole, you know, concert hall of politicians, like, regardless of the size of your audience, if you can make those people feel as if they are as integral to this conversation as the next person, suddenly they're going to listen that much more. And it's really just a matter of kind of, I don't want to say duping, but kind of luring them into something personable. You got the debates. You got Kerry and Bush going at it. Kerry really stuck to his agenda. Like, there was just this notion of, like, these are the facts, this is what I need to do, and this is what I plan. Bush, you know, God love him, he was such a, you know, as much it was like as kind of tight as my stomach got listening to him, he made it personable. And it was that last debate between the two of them where he would talk about a painting in the White House that some, you know, country bumpkin back in Texas painted for him. And it wasn't for the fact that he was giving his agenda or he wasn't talking about his points or what he would do for his election, but it was just for the fact that he brought it down a notch and made someone in Wyoming or someone in Wisconsin or someone who had no political affiliation whatsoever lean in that much closer and make them feel like Bush was a human being, that to me, as resistant and as frustrated and as angry as it made me, that was what lured people in more than anything. And I feel as if you can use that tactic. It is a tactic.
Very much. It's the human element that is vital, that is really vital in reporting, that is vital in writing.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think, I mean, all of these politicians bring up the widows of 9/11, sir, people, mothers who have children who died in the war. It's something that makes it personal. It says, these are the people that we're representing.
Yeah, it's the emo card,
exactly.
You know, and it's an easy card to play.
It's an easy card to play, so how can you kind of turn it on itself? How can you kind of take that same tactic and utilize it in a respect that, I mean, this is fiction, this is literature, but it is also taking a current topic, something that, you know, I don't ever need to mention Baghdad. I don't really need to mention the jihad, but, you know, if you... It's simply because where we are right now as a culture and what we're entrenched in at this particular point in our country's time, this is something that we share as a common vernacular. This is something that we're all aware of. You can turn on the TV and you can recognize that some of the best news reporters at this point are the terrorists with the video cameras. And it's because they have a sense of immediacy to their news. I mean, they're the ones who are creating the content, but they're also the ones structuring the content, which is why all the 6 o'clock news, which is why all the national news suddenly have to restructure and reformat and kind of essentially sensationalize their reporting in order to encompass this new medium, this new kind of form of journalism. And it's because of technology. It's because everybody has a video camera, and
right.
It's something that for some housewife, for some suburban mother to see, you know, to have that the circumstance of seeing their child, who's a relief worker in Iraq, kidnapped, held hostage, and the immediate registers to say, the only vocabulary that I've had up to this point, the only visual vernacular that can prepare me for this are my home movies. Because I have the same video camera that this person has who's holding my child hostage, or that I can turn on the TV and this is what we all share. But it has to be entrenched in something human. It can't be, like, the agenda has to be so low form. It has to be subtle enough that the audience isn't even aware of. It's the low music track on the Led Zeppelin album that tells you to, you know, worship Satan or whatever it is. It's just got to come under the radar to the point where you aren't so aware of it. I'm not spouting off any political discourse here.
Right.
I don't really need people to know who I voted for. I don't really need people to kind of look to me as an authority on politics, because I'm not. I have my opinions, and that's all I need. That's all any person should have. It's how. I mean, to me, this isn't a political piece. It's just another character dealing with a circumstance that is, if anything, much more current and
right.
topical.
Okay. No, it's not a political piece. I find it interesting that you think that the common thread throughout the entire piece is the video camera, you know, and I think the common thread throughout it is the motherhood, you know, and the frustration, and everybody watching that automatically defaults back to, what if that was my child? What if that was my husband? What if that was my mother? Mm-hmm. You know, there with the hood on her head. And that's, in my opinion, that's where the pull is, because it's just, it's this reality that we don't talk about because it's too painful. But we all know we could be over there. Mm-hmm. You know, any one of us could be over there with a hood on our head if we chose, you know, one step to the left as opposed to the direction we're taking now. Mm-hmm. Your writing is not political, although, you know, it does have, I mean, there is a political, emotional, flair to it for right now. Now, it's very different than the stuff I prep myself with. Are you receiving any flack because of it? You know, how often are you performing this out? And
well, this is brand new. You're the only other time I've read this, say, once before. It seemed appropriate, and if anything, having the radio form. Something that, you know, a subtle voice,
right.
this character, this mother, there's something, you know, having a microphone in my face right now, like there's just that sense of this seems to be the most appropriate, as opposed to like a bombastic, I wasn't going to like take the mic in my hand and start yelling or, you know,
right.
hopping around the room. But I mean, I feel like given that this is the structure, that this is where we are, you know, we're doing this radio show, having the ability to kind of lure the listener in that much more with just a soft, subtle voice, and have that moment where it just turns on a dime. First half of the story has nothing to do with terrorism or
right.
being kidnapped or this hostage, but it takes that to kind of build the foundation for the second half. And that's, and you know, hopefully at that point the hooks are in, and the depth charge blasts. But I haven't gotten flack for it yet. If anything, it's just because it hasn't been, the platform hasn't broadened itself yet. It is the second time that I've read it, and I want to keep reading it. There's one person who heard it at a reading that I did.
Where?
Who thought I was at Chop Suey.
Okay.
Chop Suey Books. And they, guy came up to me and thought that I was exploiting the current political climate.
It's not exploitive at all. So what did you do?
I said, well, thank you. I mean, like, you know, at this point, you know, with the things that I'm writing, it's going to affect them in such a way that they're either going to respond to it in a positive or negative level. And, you know, I'm neither here nor there of what's the better effect to have. I mean, it's the resonance
right.
that I'm after.
Your work is very much exploitive, you know, but exploiting the subtle and exploiting, you know, the quiet unspoken, which is...
Yeah, well, I mean, I would like to say it's the emotional. I mean, I think that, you know, for as rambunctious as it can get, for as turgid as it may be, I mean, I think that there's an emotional content to it that what... To me, there's a fine line between, like, these American Pie movies, you know, where it's just rambunctious, raunchy, perverted, crude, Porky's style sex romps.
Right.
It's almost like when we watch those movies, we can be turned off by them, we can be offended by them, but we can put them in a nice box. We can say, this is just... silly, goofy trash.
It's a movie.
Well, I mean, even like, I mean, something like a Danielle Steele novel, there's just a certain fluff to it that it never affects you in such a way that you're gonna be turned off by it. Pathos. If you can kind of instill an emotional, intellectual content into that raunch, suddenly it's become dangerous. If American Pie, where you've got people humping cherry pies or whatever it is, or, you know, doing these kind of just completely asinine pranks. If you instill a certain level of intellectual thought into it, or just like if there was.
Absolutely. I mean, that is what you do. You know, you intellectualize the obscure, you know, and you've had your characters. Mm-hmm. Your characters have slept with pumpkins, you know, or not slept with pumpkins, but had sex with pumpkins. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I mean, to me, that piece, Johnny Pumpkinseed, is purely about this emotional stunting that goes on in more rural lifestyles. If you've got a kid whose only, like, his home environment and his own exposure is purely this rural terrain. I mean, it's farm. It's acres after acres of fields. Your nearest neighbor is miles away. And you're this kid. You're this boy who suddenly has the kind of hormonal impetus, and there's nowhere to channel. You have nowhere to go with this brewing sensation that has no valid or palpable release. What are you going to do? And, I mean, so many people want to, you know, assume that the piece is about humping pumpkins.
Right. No, and I didn't mean to mislead anybody.
No.
It's not about mm-hmm. humping pumpkins. He just happens to do that. Mm-hmm.
And it's for the fact that there's this hormonal curdling point for the guy. I mean, 13-year-old, 16-year-old kid has no immediate release for this sensation that he has no concept of. His parents are going to talk to him about it. The birds and the bees is some ethereal concept that has no bearings whatsoever on his life. And yet there's this thing inside him that he has no comprehension of, and it's something that's not going away. So what is the most immediate release? What's the most you know, how do you kind of rectify with this sensation inside you? And for him, for that character, it was the only choice. And you know, the tongue is definitely planted pretty deep into the cheek, but I think that's the only way to talk about it. I mean, it's a funny, goofy piece about hormonal
coming of age.
Yeah, exactly, coming of age, but having this kind of like hitting your hormones against the wall because you don't have the proper, you know, you don't know how to, you're just not growing up.
Well, that's the problem with teenage boys, you know.
Exactly.
No, there is no outlet for them because they're teenagers.
Mm-hmm. So for me, you know, a lot of the raunchier pieces that I've written, it's not for the sex sake or for the exploitative nature of making for a cheap laugh, as like American Pie or a lot of these.
And it doesn't come across like that at all.
Oh man, you would be surprised. Like I mean, know your audience to the degree that, you know, if I'm going to do a reading at a private Episcopalian school, like I have to be aware of what I'm getting into. There's a piece in Rest Area that Johnny Pumpkinseed's in called The Pool Witch, and it's a piece about three little boys who are at a water park.
Right, I read it last night.
Yeah, and it's
sorry, but not everybody has finished your intro there.
No, it's just a goofy piece. It's about three kids who, you know, they're bridging the gap pretty quickly from pre-adolescence to adolescence, and it all happens one day at a water park when they see this one lifeguard, and they don't have the vocabulary to understand why they feel this way towards this woman, so they turn it into some swashbuckler pirate story. And I did that piece for a group of like 9th to 10th to 12th graders, assuming, and this was the first time that I had read it, and I was under the assumption that who better to read this piece for, like who would understand this piece more than anyone else? Of course, the people who are going through it themselves. Of course, like, you know, there would be this sense of, well, here we are, we're all in this together. I've been there, you're there right now. Like, this is as close to a literary sex ed movie film strip that you're gonna have. And I thought they would enjoy it. I thought it would be fun. Did it pretty quiet. You know, could hear the crickets chirping. And I left that school thinking that, you know, that didn't go great. But it wasn't until probably like an hour or so later that I got a phone call from the principal saying that we had to have a talk. And two of these English teachers had come in. The principal was there, the art teacher. It took that one kid to go home, tell their mom, this crazy guy came into class today, started ranting and raving about pirates and sex and water slides. And all of a sudden, I found myself in the position of needing to apologize to these students. And the only reason why I bring it up is because...
No, don't you dare interrupt your stories.